I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The pandemic has made most things worse, including this country's opioid drug crisis. There were 93,000 overdose deaths in 2020. That's a 30% increase over 2019, most of them from opioids. The country was struggling with a drug overdose epidemic before COVID, which has only exacerbated the crisis because of the isolation from lockdowns, the closure of treatment centers, the impact of financial and emotional stress, and the lethality of fentanyl. A study of overdoses in Philadelphia by researchers at Penn Medicine found that fatal overdoses among Black residents spiked right after Pennsylvania's stay-at-home orders, while they dropped for white residents. This follows a pattern of racial disparity revealed by the pandemic. Today on Radio Times, understanding the power of drug addiction, especially opioid addiction, what it takes to get someone off drugs, and why a medical approach to treatment has shown success. We have three guests, two of whom join us here in our Philadelphia studio. Andre Reed is an activist consultant with Lived Experience Consultants and the Philadelphia chapter of NAMA, which is the National Alliance of Medically Assisted Recovery. Andre Reed, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us and here with us in our Philadelphia studio, Nicole O'Donnell. She's a certified recovery specialist at the University of Pennsylvania. Nicole, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And joining us by phone is Jean Marie Perrone. She's a professor of emergency medicine, director of medical toxicology and addiction medicine initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, and the founding director of Penn Medicine Center for Addiction Medicine and Policy. Jean Marie Perrone, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to make sure that you can join us at any time during the show. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I mentioned this in my introduction about how the pandemic has made things worse, but I want to speak to the three of you, frankly, about what you have seen. And perhaps, Nicole, I can start with you in terms of how you see the pandemic really exacerbating this problem of drug addiction, especially opioid addiction. What have you seen in Philadelphia?
Yeah, I mean, it's been so exacerbated. The disconnection from programs, the disparities, the people not having the technology to stay connected to other people, because in Philadelphia, a lot of our, you know, population doesn't have the technology to stay, you know, do things virtually or do things by phone. So the pandemic money was exacerbated, the opiate epidemic.
Because there was money, you mean?
All the stressors and then having the money, right?
The two of them together.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, during outreach, there weren't as many resources out when we were in, you know, in Kensington and West Philly doing, making sure people had Narcan and fentanyl test strips and make sure that they could get clean syringes. So there weren't as many resources out there.
Right. And I'm thinking, too, Andre, about just, you know, we had to keep our distance. I mean, I think things are a little different now. People are vaccinated, hopefully. People are wearing masks, hopefully. But nonetheless, the kind of distance that you had to have to stay away from someone who could be struggling with drug addiction, but also could be positive for the COVID virus.
Well, I think we was dealing with a problem before the COVID came, right?
Right.
So then when COVID came, it shut down all systems. So as Nicole said, people who had relationships and was building support systems, their support system stopped. They couldn't go to their programs no more because at a point we didn't know what we were dealing with, right? So everything goes on halt. So the people in recovery, their lives go on halt as well. So their lives shut down. They can't go to their treatment centers anymore. They can't get the services they need. So, and same again, like Nicole said, then you exacerbate it with people who already struggle, have triggers, right? And I'm not saying you don't need to give people money, but when you got the stimulus money,
sure,
and you start getting, you know, money that was inundated into the community, you know, without having proper supports around them to show them how to, you know, deal with this whole influx of things that was going on, right? So we know drug addiction come from feelings, right? So you
feelings,
shut people down,
right?
Feelings can cause the behavior, which causes the usage, right? So a lot of people went to depression, loss of jobs and surety, what's going on? People were dying around them. Loved ones was dying.
Anxiety, too, right?
Anxiety, all these supports, all these things that were happening to them. And then you don't have a support system because the treatment center's closed down. You got to do it by phone. And again, if you live in a life full of poverty, you can't keep a phone every month. Number $60 is a key. For us, we take it for granted. But in the beginning of my recovery, $60 was a lot of money to keep my phone bill up.
I hear you. I want to get back to the two of you, but Jean-Marie Perron, let me get you in on the conversation. Just to, from your perspective, what did you see, especially during the really dark days of the pandemic, you know, before vaccines, before we really understood what we were dealing with?
Oh, absolutely. Early March was terrible. And, you know, as things began to shut down and almost before it got really bad, it was already impacting these communities because of fear and isolation and people kind of turning their backs on the programs that existed. And then subsequently, starting in April, May, what we would see in the emergency department are these people falling out of care, but then returning to use also as a result of unemployment. They would tell us later, you know, I had my last prescription for Suboxone in March. But then, you know, I just went off the rails in April, May, June because I wasn't working. And work was a structure that helped with my recovery. And now I don't have that. So it was really difficult. And, you know, for our open treatment program, kind of walk-in treatment in our emergency department, we were seeing far less people who were willing to come to the emergency department for treatment. But we were seeing far more people who were coming in after overdose. So. Non-fatal overdoses were rising. And again, that's the impact Andre spoke about in terms of people losing, you know, friends immediately from the very first few days of the pandemic.
Is it any better now, Jean-Marie Perron?
I believe that we have shifted a lot of resources to make them more accessible. But as Nicole and Andre both said, still we face the challenge. If, you know, we provide telehealth services, but people still don't have telehealth access, we're still trying to be innovative in being able to create that virtual line to care. But we're not able to reach everyone. So I think it's the new normal, but it's not where we were before in terms of getting people low barrier access to treatment.
One of the reasons, there are a number of reasons, Nicole and Andre, we wanted you on is you have this lived experience. And I think for people who don't understand addiction, just don't understand the sort of the pull of addiction, you're here in part to help people understand because of your own struggles, but ability to overcome your own addiction. And I wanted, Nicole, if I could just hear from you about, it was heroin, right?
It was, correct, yep.
And do you know what sort of, what triggered maybe your is addiction too strong a word, but your tug into heroin?
No, it was definitely an addiction. We can call it that. It started out with pills. It started out with, you know, it was fun. And then you can't really afford those for long. And then I ended up doing heroin because it's cheaper and more accessible.
And you also, you ended up in an ER, right?
I absolutely did. And that's why I wanted to do the work that I do at Penn with Jean-Marie, because when I went to the emergency department after two overdoses, there weren't resources. There weren't people, you know, bedside to talk to me about, you know, there's a better way. There's, you don't have to live like this, this, you know, all of these things. And that's why I ended up at Penn, because I wanted to be the person I didn't have bedside when I experienced my overdoses.
What did you want? What did you want someone to say bedside to you as you were, you know, coming out of this overdose?
Sure. I wanted compassion. I wanted non-judgment, and I just wanted connection. I don't know if I would have, you know, accepted some kind of treatment, but I did. I would have liked to know that there were options for that. And I just wanted to feel not judged.
Not judged.
Mm-hmm.
Andre, from your own experience, and you also had an addiction to heroin.
Yeah.
What got you started?
I don't know what really got me started. I think, like Nicole said, recreation, right? But now as I study it more and look at it, I really think that was predisposed. I think it's predisposition to drugs, right? I don't think that the nature, nurture. I think that, you know, our brain, right? I really now, I look at it from a brain structure. My body, just my brain was just ideal for when heroin it met it, and it made a match, right? But more so into the addiction, the horrors of addiction. We already know what the horrors of addiction, loss of job, loss of school, loss of employment, loss of friends, ostracized from families. How hard it was to come back.
To come back from all that.
The connections that weren't there, the judgment, the you know, and then being African-American, the services that was out there, the disparities in services, disparity in health care, the treatment for health care, that bridge the gap. Always talking about bridging the gap. and you know, I talked to Nicole about that. We talk about bridging the gap. Can you imagine the bridge I had to come over?
Mm-hmm. Is that in part because when we look at race and drug addiction, we see someone like you as a criminal versus someone, you know, in need of services?
Right. And I was telling your producer, Debbie, yesterday, the reason I can kind of see the addiction from these kids' eyes today, because I basically came from the same world that they came from. I came from the suburbs. I was a kid that was in college when I first used. So I wasn't a guy in a corner selling drugs, no job, no education. So I kind of, when I look at them, I say, a lot of people drive by and say, well, how did you get here? A lot of those people come from worlds, productive worlds, and found themselves taken over by an addiction. So I knew that a lot of them didn't start off on that corner where they want to have a sign in their hand asking you for a dollar. So because I knew that, I could link up and get, say, these people didn't start here at Fifth and Gerard at the corner with a sign, with a bucket in their hand asking you for a dollar. When you ride past them, they stinking. I mean, they have odor and all these things that we look at, and then we judge them. We judge them, we look at them like that. They didn't start there, mm-hmm. right? And I didn't start there either.
And was there something in your life that happened that you were sort of like, we were hearing from Nicole that you know, you were maybe ready to give up?
To
see that I don't want to do this anymore.
I think medically assisted treatment. Mm-hmm. I think when I began to accept that medically assisted treatment was out there for a great reason, right? Because that's a prejudice in itself, right? Methadone, Suboxone, and Vivitrol, we call it medically assisted treatment. It was a prejudice behind it. But I met a good therapist at the program I was going to, not mm-hmm. going to mention it. But and with that connection, I was being able to see that this, if I use this medication right, it could work.
Was that same? You're nodding your head, Nicole.
No, my experience is I had to use diverted buprenorphine because it wasn't accessible when I got into recovery. So to get through withdrawal, that's what I had to do. But it is the evidence-based treatment. I'm really happy that it worked for Andre, and it's working for a lot of people. But he's right. There is a stigma surrounding it, unfortunately.
We're almost up in a break here, but what is the stigma?
We live in a world where abstinence-based is the gold standard, which isn't true because it's also not evidence-based and people are dying because of it.
Well, let's take a short break and then we'll mm-hmm. get back to our conversation. And Jean Marie Perrone, I want to get you back in on the conversation as well. We are talking about drug addiction and frankly, I think the pandemic and other crises that we have been dealing with in this country has really overshadowed this enduring problem that we have, not just here in Philadelphia, but across the country. Talking with Andre Reed. He's a consultant, founded Lived Experience Consultants and Philadelphia chapter of NAMA. That's the National Alliance of Medically Assisted Recovery. We just heard about some of that. Nicole O'Donnell, certified recovery specialist at the University of Pennsylvania. And Jean Marie Perrone, professor of emergency medicine, director of medical toxicology and addiction medicine initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Do stay with us. Much more after this short break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with our guests about the opioid epidemic, the role that fentanyl is playing. I do want to get to that and what can be done to address the problem. Let me turn back to you, Jean Marie Perrone, and help us understand this medical, I hope that's the right word, this medical approach to addiction and what we know about it and why it seems to be working at least for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's a tremendous successful story of pharmacology and interventions, but one that people don't understand. I think to pick up on what Nicole was saying, abstinence is a really easy concept because when we look at patients who have alcohol use disorder, we want them to go into treatment. We want them to get away from alcohol. Alcohol is prevalent everywhere, and the only real treatment or the most common treatment that's supported by Alcoholics Anonymous is abstinence. So you won't drink anymore, and then you won't go down this pathway. Mm-hmm. There isn't a lot of, there are some, but there are very few medications that are used with alcohol treatment. In contrast, opioid use disorder is very different, and it responds really well to specific treatments, including methadone and buprenorphine, otherwise known as Suboxone. Suboxone specifically can reduce overdose deaths by up to 60% in a patient who continues. So we don't have that kind of data for Alcoholics Anonymous, but we have this social network around Alcoholics Anonymous that continues to support the idea that you're only really in recovery if you're not taking anything, and that this idea that those people who resort to taking meds aren't as strong, aren't really in recovery, haven't really faced the hard questions, and are using this as a crutch. And we heartily disapprove of that concept and really want to foster this idea that these medications are just like insulin for diabetes. You are missing a medication, that a substance that has changed your brain, just like a diabetic person doesn't have insulin because their pancreas isn't working. We need to put an opioid receptor agonist, as we say, back into the brain. And you may need to be on that medicine for a long time, but it is just like we wouldn't think about taking somebody off of insulin. This is the same thing. It's a chronic relapsing disease of the brain. We have medications that are effective. We want people to understand that treatment is available.
I mean, what you're saying is that addiction to drugs, whether it's, I mean, there's so many different kinds of drugs, is different from an addiction to alcohol. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, there's characteristics of the loss of you know, life resources that are common to all when you have an addiction problem. But the treatment is quite different. And we, you know, encourage thinking about them differently in order to get people to not feel discouraged if they're on medication, and to feel that they are also entitled to hold their head up high and not be stigmatized that they are in, you know, taking medications to assist in their recovery, and to, you know, essentially make them whole, and you know, as most of our patients say, it just makes me feel normal again. They don't get high, they don't have euphoria, but they just feel back to themselves, and that's a gift.
So what are in these medications that make them so effective?
Buprenorphine or Suboxone is something that also binds to the opioid receptor, much like heroin would. However, it doesn't have as much of the heroin effects, about 50% less of those effects. So it really just replaces the withdrawal and the gap of opioid dependence that you might have developed without giving you the feeling of sleepiness or extra euphoria. So it really just brings you back to a normal baseline. You would not know if somebody was on Suboxone. Right. They appear completely like anyone else. So it is essentially replacing what has been, you know, hurt in their brain from this relapsing disease.
And relapsing disease, if I can turn to you, Nicole, I mean, from the work that you've done and even from your own experience, that at least as I understand it, that relapse is part of recovery, or it has been part of recovery.
Sure. I mean, it doesn't have to be, right? Everybody's pathway is different. But what we do is, if a patient is experiencing reoccurrence of use, we ensure that they're safe, right? So make sure that they know not to use alone, make sure that they have Narcan, make sure that they know to test their drugs, make sure that they have clean syringes. So we then take a harm reduction approach to ensure that when that person wants to come back, if they want to come back, that they're safe and able to do so.
Can you talk a bit, Andre, about Narcan and some of these interventions that can help people who are in the midst of an overdose?
Well, I think Narcan is a great drug, right? So when people return to use, we got to know that they have to save their lives, right? We have to save their lives. We can't get punitive against them and not say nothing that should be there to save their lives. So return to use is a common occurrence between people that use, right? So putting Narcan, naloxone, that's basically what Narcan is, right? Putting it in there, spreading it in the community. I think in all communities that Narcan should be in a house like a smoke detector is. I think we should have those same type of campaigns, because you never know who's going to come in your house. You never know who might be under the influence, because we find the fentanyl in all drugs now, right? So it should be as common as being in your medicine cabinet, in your kitchen cabinet, somewhere in the house where everyone knows that it's a Narcan kit here.
How easy is it to use?
It's fairly easy. As the technology is going along, evidence-based practices, Nicole was saying, is made. At one time, it started off, you know, and you had to go to trainers. But now, you basically read the box and find out how to use it. It's coming that common now, right? Because we know it's one of the major tools in saving lives.
Well, let me go back to you, Jean Marie Perrone, and Andre Reed mentioned fentanyl. Is our problem fentanyl, or is it opioids? Is it the combination of the two?
The problem has gotten much worse primarily because of fentanyl. Fentanyl is more potent than heroin, and it's really now adulterated or intentionally put into cocaine and methamphetamine and lots of other substances where people were not opioid tolerant. So there's a certain number of deaths that are occurring because people didn't expect to get an opioid. And then there's also people who don't know that they're using fentanyl because they're buying pills on the street, which you imagine, you know, came from a pharmacy and is probably, you know, safer than heroin. But actually, these pills are being manufactured to look like commercial pills, and they're actually pressed fentanyl tablets of pure opioid. So they think they're buying Percocet or Xanax, and they're actually getting a very potent dose of fentanyl. So it's just being distributed in many different ways, so people are getting exposed. And then the appetite for opioids in general has just escalated because of the overprescribing that occurred in the 2000s. So we're still trying to kind of reel back from that and get people to not even explore some of these substances because they can be so lethal even with exploration.
And how lethal is fentanyl, and sort of how much more powerful is it than it's a synthetic opioid, correct, Jean Marie?
It's a synthetic opioid. It's about 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine. So it is, in very small quantities. And because of that potency, it's easier to import occultly. And so what I've told from the DEA is that fentanyl is here to stay. It's infinitely cheaper than, you know, buying a plant-based opium product like heroin. And because of its potency, it can be, you know, more easily exported and arrives here in a very potent form that can be, you know, distributed as is happening.
Wow.
So it's not going away is what I'm hearing.
And that's Jean Marie Perrone. She's a professor of emergency medicine, director of medical toxicology and addiction medicine initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also founding director of Penn Medicine Center for Addiction Medicine and Policy. Also with us, Nicole O'Donnell. She's a certified recovery specialist at the University of Pennsylvania. Andre Reed, the third of our three guests this hour of Radio Times. He's an activist consultant with the Lived Experience Consultants and the Philadelphia chapter of NAMA, the National Alliance of Medically Assisted Recovery. We're talking about the opioid epidemic, the drug epidemic here in Philadelphia and, frankly, across the country. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Nicole, let me go back to you and just help us understand the kinds of conversations you as well, Andre, that you have with people that you see, let's say, on the street. We know up in, for instance, in Kensington, there's the encampment where a lot of people are addicted to drugs. I know in West Philadelphia there are places like that as well, maybe not on the same scale. But how do you engage someone who's using?
With snacks. So
snacks.
Yeah. No, it's that's how you engage people when I'm doing community outreach. There's snacks and some love and some non-judgment, and that's how the conversations start, right? When you're out in the community, sometimes the conversations are a little bit different, right? They're harm reduction conversations. Here's my card. These are options. Maybe today is not your day, but give me a call when it is. Or if it's not, give me a call anyway so I can make sure that you have the Narcan, the fentanyl test strips, and the safe syringes, right? The conversations in the emergency department are a little bit different. People come sometimes seeking help, or they, are coming in for ramifications from opiate use disorder or, addiction in general. So a lot of education happens in the emergency department. We're seeing a lot of people come from the West Philly community that don't know that they're getting fentanyl. Mm-hmm. They think that they're using pills. So a lot of education around harm reduction and, you know, educating people about fentanyl and what they're using is like imperative. Like that is what has to happen and what is happening both in the community and the emergency departments.
Andre, you want to add to that? I mean, and I we should underscore that fentanyl is so dangerous and so lethal, and people don't know enough about it. That's what I'm getting from the three of you. Andre, can you add to that?
I think the community is aware of fentanyl now, right? I do think they know that it's a deadly substance out there that's killing a lot of people. What I don't think the community know is that it's in weed, it's in mm-hmm. pills, that a lot of these pills, like Dr. Marie said, is, you know, manufactured counterfeit pills. So when you look at it from a systemic perspective, West Philly will look a lot different than Kensington, right? Mm-hmm. Because the infrastructure in West Philly is not the same. So we have to put programs in West Philly. We have to, you know, there's a lot of other stuff. So my outreach more so is from a systemic perspective now, after doing a lot of community outreach now, looking at how do I change systems and policies to start providing the services in certain communities that don't even have people coming to them because they don't even think the problem is even occurring. Out, you know, West Philly doesn't have the encampment, but it has the deaths.
Right.
It does. It has the same addiction, has the same loss of lives, destruction of homes, loss of employment. But the infrastructure and the policies and people aren't running there. They're not rushing down South Philly. They're not rushing down West Philly. They're not rushing to Southwest or Logan or Anoli because, you know, systemically, we haven't built the infrastructure there to deal with the problem, even if we do rush there.
Do you want to add to that, Jean Marie?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what I see. So I'm a clinician in the emergency department. Right. And while I think Andre is very correct that people are aware that fentanyl is bad, they're not aware that they might be using fentanyl. So we recently started testing people for fentanyl because that was a new substance. And so when people come in and they, you know, they think they're addicted to heroin or Percocet, and we tell them, you know, your urine drug screen only showed fentanyl. You're not getting any other opioid. They are absolutely terrified. And that can be a good trigger to help them continue the path into treatment because they know it's lethal, but they don't know that they're actually being exposed to it. So I think that's an important opportunity to make a treatable moment out of that concern. They think that fentanyl is something that they're not, you know, not getting. And when in fact, most of the people in our city are actually getting some or all fentanyl in their drugs.
Wow. I mean, that is so frightening. Let me get Heather Arata to join our conversation. She's joining us by phone, and I should say that she and her husband and her son, Brendan, were profiled in the Philadelphia Inquirer recently. Sadly, her son, Brendan, died of overdose. And Heather Arata, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. I appreciate the phone call.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I do want to say I appreciate the work that all the three panelists today are doing in their respective areas of expertise. And it gives me hope that, you know, we are working in the right direction for this this terrible disease.
What happened to your son, Brendan?
So Brendan was diagnosed around the age of 15 as bipolar disorder and took a long journey through his mental illness and was treated from the time he was that age once he was diagnosed. We found that particularly in his case, he was sort of stabilized on the lower end of the depressive state instead of the mania. They always worked with his medications to try and figure out exactly how to stabilize him. But for many years of his life, he was suicidally depressed. He was in a psych ward in a local hospital for probably four times for his depression. And he started to self-medicate for his depression, which led him to opioids, and that led him to heroin. And the unfortunate statistic that you're talking about, that fentanyl is what is killing a lot of people these days who are taking street drugs, that's what was on Brennan's death certificate, that he died from an adverse reaction to fentanyl.
I'm so sorry to hear that. And I do appreciate your call. And I know from reading the article about you started the Opioid Crisis Action Network. What does that do?
So in 2018, our son died in December of 2017. In 2018, my husband and I co-founded the Opioid Crisis Action Network. What we are doing currently is raising money to help people who can't afford treatment. So we sponsor a few people a year in recovery homes or wellness homes so they can afford the rent, get themselves back on their feet once they're on a road to recovery and want to stay on a wellness path. And many times people have lost their jobs, they're coming out of jail, and they need the opportunity to have some stress-free, no-worry kind of days coming up. So we pay for a few months' rent for people in recovery homes. If there's treatments to pay for medical bills, we try and do that. Currently, we're very small. We're working on our 501c3 status so that we can try to expand our scope of aid to people. And we also are working with some state legislators to try and bring some transparency around outcomes within the recovery homes. Mm-hmm. So when my husband and I were searching for recovery homes for our son, there's really no data that can say that this is a very good recovery home because we see this many days of wellness in our patients. And so we're working with some state legislators. We have a few prime sponsors of that bill, and hopefully we'll see some movement on that in the coming months. And the second thing that happened to our son, and we've heard this story multiple times, is he felt some urges to relapse, and his sister drove him to a recovery a facility, and they wanted to admit him. But because he wasn't currently under the influence of any type of drugs, the insurance company would not cover his being admitted to the facility. And that's a story that we've heard many times. There is a law that states if someone presents at your ER or at your facility and they are under the influence, that you cannot turn them away. And so I hear your radio.
Well, you know what, Heather? Hold on, because I don't want to. We're right in the middle of a very important piece of this story. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the drug epidemic. Drug overdoses have risen something like 30% since the start of the pandemic, and many of those overdoses are from opioids, and a lot of that is from fentanyl. We're talking with our three guests about all of that, and we also have Heather Arada, who called us in to talk about her son, Brendan, who died of an overdose a couple of years ago, and the work that she's doing to provide housing for people who need housing and also need help and support dealing with their addiction. Heather, I do want to get back to you just to give you a chance to finish. You were talking about the importance of transparency, especially when it comes to these recovery houses or these wellness houses.
Yes, that's correct. So basically what we would like to do is have the state of Pennsylvania send out surveys to the homes, an optional opportunity for these homes to respond, and just give us information of, some basic kind of demographic information, how many people their house holds. And the one that's most important to us is something that Andre is advocating for, is that that these houses support people who are in medication-assisted recovery. Right. And as Jean Marie stated, people who are on this type of medication-assisted treatment have a much greater chance, and she stated up to 60% better chance of not dying from an opioid overdose. So it's important to us that these homes support people who are pursuing that type of treatment.
Well, Heather Rutta, I really appreciate you calling into the show, and I'm so sorry to hear about your son, and I'm so gratified to hear about the work that you're doing as a result of what happened to him. So thanks for calling into the show.
Thanks. Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. Andre, do you want to respond since Heather mentioned your name in terms of this medical treatment, which I think is one of the messages of the show that we're doing today?
I just think of all the lives that could have been saved had we been on this medical model, and not from a medical model. Medical model means a lot of stuff, but medically assisted treatment model, right? Had we promoted, encouraged, and supported the evidence-based practices of using medically assisted treatment. So a lot of times, people, I'm going to say kids because they're younger than me, but they were walking in the programs and they were getting diagnosed and they weren't given medically assisted treatment. So they were going out there, like Nicole and Dr. Marie mentioned, on an abstinence base, knowing that their brain had been changed and it was almost impossible. And they started faulting themselves when they would go back, when they returned to use. They felt like it was a moral deficiency. They weren't strong enough. The family members was not support them because they wouldn't think that they were strong enough. Not knowing that when you get into the studying of it, they were up against a brick wall they couldn't get past. So I think of all the people who possibly could have been received medically assisted treatment, the statistics show 60%, as you guys say this morning, and just look at the lives we could have saved had we gave them that their first time stepping into treatment.
Well, let me read a comment from Mike. Please be specific about how many programs are available. What are the statistics? How many people are being successfully helped? Where are we generally speaking? And back to you, Jean Marie Perron. I mean, again, just to kind of underscore what we've been talking about is that there are treatments that show not just promise, but show success.
Oh, absolutely. And the lowest barrier treatment is being able to take something prescribed by your doctor, and that is Suboxone. So unlike methadone, which is also effective, patients who take methadone, which works, are required to go to the clinic every single day in most cases. So that is stigmatizing in and of itself. Another path is to encourage clinicians, primary care doctors, psychiatrists, family medicine doctors, anyone to take the training to be able to prescribe Suboxone from your office so that clinicians and patients can be treated in a setting that offers privacy and non-stigmatizing care and mainstreams addiction care with all the other problems that you might have, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. It can all be part of a return to health that doesn't face this segregation of your treatment. You have to go here because you've got that problem. It's all part of holistic health. So we really encourage that. And the Department of Health in Philadelphia has really supported clinicians in taking on this additional treatment goal. And actually, clinicians love it. People, you know, it's wonderful to see someone in recovery and to see their new journey and how quickly they can get back to all the things that mattered to them. So, you know, working with Nicole and Andre, we are trying to get the word out. We're trying to get people onto treatment, but also having a peer, somebody who's experienced this, is an unmeasurable addition to our treatment team. And that's Nicole being able to talk to a patient in a way that a patient's going to trust her more than they necessarily would, you know, and trust me.
Sure. I understand that. I'm looking at you, Nicole. Anything you want to add to that? I mean, and there is nothing like a lived experience and being able to talk to someone sort of peer to peer.
Exactly. So when I meet a patient with an overdose, it's sad that I have to talk through the stigma of medication before we talk about the medication that could possibly save their life, right? There's so much stigma surrounding it. And when somebody wakes up from an overdose, that's the first thing they're concerned about before accepting, you know, when we go through the treatment options. And coming from a peer who is in recovery to say, you're also in recovery, like I will validate that you're in recovery, that's why the conversation's a little bit different.
Right. Here's a question from Bill. He says, is it possible for someone to be so deep into addiction that there's no hope for them? And back to you, Nicole, but also to you, Andre.
Absolutely not. If someone is breathing, there is hope.
Right. Do you feel the same way, Andre?
Yeah, definitely. If you're alive, there's hope. If you can hear people on the phone, if you can hear a voice of someone telling you, it's hope. From like me and Nicole, we're hope. That's why when you first said, do you mind we disclose it? No, we're hope. It's hope that you never... Sometimes people look at me, and I can almost say to Nicole, I can say this, and look at us and think we started here, sitting at radio shows with good jobs and good lives. No, we didn't.
No.
Right? We met someone who was able to breathe hope into us.
Right.
And so that same gentleman that asked you that question, he'll meet somebody eventually that make it breathe hope into him. We pray, right?
And for you, Nicole, I mean, mm-hmm. was there someone that breathed hope into your life, or a series of someones?
There were a series of someones, right? I have a family, a very supportive family that I'm so grateful for every day. At the end, I think that what really got me into recovery is I was sick of trying not to overdose, but not wanting to wake up. That was the end.
Oh.
I was trying not to overdose, right? I was trying not to die, but also really upset every time I did wake up because I woke up in withdrawal every day. That was every day at the end of my addiction, and that's why I started to try to figure out that, you know, what I was going to do.
I mean, that's a complicated thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not wanting to overdose, but also not wanting to wake up at the same time.
Yep. Yep. That's how the end was.
Yeah.
Every day.
Every
yeah.
day. How about for you, Andre?
I think it was just family, right? So, you know, I'm from Baltimore, but then I have family of choices, we say, in South Philly. So I have two families. So that's the love and support that I had for my family that always seen that I was better than what I was showing.
Oh. You know, believed. I mean,
they believed in me. They believed in me, both sides of my family, my South Philly family, my Baltimore family, always had the hope and support from them. You know what I mean? So I didn't really experience some of the things that in my addiction I'm grateful for. My daughter's grandmother, I always had a house over my head. I always had somewhere to live. I always had somewhere to... So I had family supports like that, right? So, but I think it was a deterioration of my life. I just, you know, I was just looking at my life and I was like, Dre, what are you doing with your life?
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't the horrors of me living in an encampment, but what people don't know is that at the end, the bottom is done. See, people have a determination for what the bottom is. The bottom is done, no matter where your done is.
So the bottom for you is, for anybody, is just...
Done.
That's it.
Right.
There is nothing below this.
There's nothing, though. It doesn't have to be a place, right? It just be a time... In the fate of life where you come to and you just say, I'm done. You could be in a mansion, you could be in a shooting gallery. But, you know, when that time comes, when everything forces line up and you start seeing the time is done, now it's time to get to work. And I just want to say this is very important. I think a lot of time we celebrate people in recovery from the one who gives us the you know, from that 12-step model. But I think what Nicole and people like Dr. Marie and we do is we celebrate all people in recovery. No matter what phase you're at, you need to be celebrated. You know, you need to be encouraged, supported, and tell you're doing a great job. That person who wakes up every day that's using and somehow finds his way to treatment is a person that really needs to be celebrated even more so than me who, when I got clean, can make it to treatment more easily. That guy is getting out of a shooting gallery, getting out of using, and somehow still pushing against a tsunami of trying to get the supports that he needs. So that guy that's emailing you today, that's hope for him, asking you a question. Is it hope for me? Because we tell him, yeah, then he'll get up. He might say, well, okay, they said, yeah. These guys who know mm-hmm. say, yeah. So we got to break down how we look at it, right? Everybody who's in the process, because it took me 20 years to get 15 years, and it wasn't all included, if you understand what I'm saying.
I do, totally.
Right? So that's how I look at it. So when you say how we engage, I don't engage from a point of abstinence or time.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the process.
Let me go to you, Jean Marie Perrone, and actually a couple of comments here about if we decriminalize drugs, you know, would this somehow affect what we've been talking about during this hour? How do you see that? And I realize that's a big policy question. And, you know, anyway, I'd just be curious about how mm-hmm. how you wrestle with that, if you do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, decriminalization is important because it's an equity issue. And so, you know, but I don't want to see decriminalization go with increasing use, much like, you know, marijuana, legalization of marijuana. What I see happen is that, you know, marijuana now doesn't, you know, is such a low barrier thing that kids have to try other things because marijuana isn't illegal. So I worry that raising the bar to, you know, making drugs less of a a problem, that it decreases the hurdle to start drug use. And that is just a dangerous cascade in my mind, because, you know, people can try alcohol. We know teenagers try marijuana and alcohol. And what do they learn from that? They learn that they weren't supposed to use marijuana, they weren't supposed to use alcohol, and it was maybe okay for them. So then they go to the next step. And when that next step includes an opioid, there's not really a lot of turning back. And so it's just a lot stickier, it's a lot more addictive, and, you know, we end up with a lot more people unknowingly going down this path. So it's a complex issue,
sure,
but I worry about the leap.
No, and I appreciate the nuance that you gave us there. I'm just looking at the clock here. Nicole, if I can go back to you, and also to you, Andre, in terms of when literally I'm thinking of 2020, when we really did shut down, and this interesting study actually in Philadelphia showing that Black residents were harder hit by the shutdown with drug addiction, frankly, than white people living here in the city. Nonetheless, a problem across the board. But when you were able to connect with someone, let's say by their phone or even if they had a computer, could you see something about their life that you might not have seen if they'd come to the office or they were in your ER?
So that's a great question. We did go virtual in the emergency room, right? So we had the iPads. If a patient presented, I got to meet with them. And, you know, I really missed the connection, right? Like, I missed the hugs. I missed the body language. I missed all of those things. So I don't think that I found out anything or missed anything virtually as opposed to being in person. I missed a lot about being in person.
Yeah. How about for you, Andre?
Yeah, but when you see that, when you say the increase in death or decrease among African American people, what people need to know, the cracks was already there.
The
all
cracks
there
were
was,
already there.
All, yeah. there, all that happened was it just got exposed. So it ain't like it's just something that was new. Disparity to health care, disparity to education, disparity to poverty, no equities in the Black and African American community was already there. And when you sprinkle extra problems on, like COVID, where people couldn't get services, couldn't get employment, then you just start seeing people fall through the cracks more. But it wasn't like it was paved over and was covered up. No, it was already there. It was waiting to be exposed. Now we've seen, and what is the solution to the problem, really?
Yeah. To you, Jean Marie Perron, there's an anonymous comment. Can you please address the high cost of Suboxone? Is it expensive?
It is covered by Medicaid. It is about $120 for a one-week prescription without, or maybe $65 or so for a one-week prescription, depending on the dose. So that is expensive, but relatively speaking, for saving a life, it's not as expensive, and it is well covered by, you know, local insurances, at least in Philadelphia. I wish we could do better, but you know, just the fact that you need a prescription is obviously a barrier, and that even if pharmacies don't always carry it is another barrier. So fortunately, it is at least covered by the insurances that most of our patients have.
Nicole, you've got a look on your face.
Yeah, and there's many programs that don't require insurance in the city of Philadelphia. Like if Prevention Point does a mobile Suboxone and they don't require insurance, so there are options if you don't have insurance.
There's a lot of generics out there as well.
And fair enough.
Big on generics. So.
Well, look, I really appreciate all the work that all three of you were doing and the fact that you joined us on Radio Times. And special thanks to you, Andre Reed, and to you, Nicole O'Donnell, for sharing your life story as well, because that's an important part of this overall story. So thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Andre Reed is an activist consultant who founded Lived Experience Consultants and Philadelphia chapter of NAMA, again, the National Alliance of Medically Assisted Recovery. Nicole O'Donnell, certified recovery specialist at the University of Pennsylvania. Jean Marie Perron, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're welcome.
Really important.
Absolutely. And she's a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, founding director of the Penn Medicine Center for Addiction Medicine and Policy. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the programming. And you can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Tina Kaleke and Al Banks, the engineer for engineers, for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.